It's out of here! Home run, Lenny Dykstra!
Stairs rips one into the night, deep into right, way out of here.
The Phillies win the game on a base hit by Mitch Williams at 4:40 in the morning.
Swing and a miss, struck him out. It's wacky, wonderful. Bunch of throwbacks has won the National League pennant.
Welcome to Continued Success, yet another Phillies podcast that's a part of the Good Fight podcast family. I am Justin Clue, the head guy at the Good Fight. With me is Liz Rocher of Yahoo Sports to talk some Phillies, present and past. Hello, Liz.
Hello, Justin.
We are having a good time this week, and we are having a good time because the Phillies did not lose that third game of the series with the Mets, which is to say Hector Neris didn't allow an additional run to score in that third game with the Mets. We were probably one outside or inside pitch away from this being a very, very more morose podcast than you're going to get tonight.
Feeling a lot, it would have felt a lot more like last year and the year before that and every other year where the Phillies lost a lot to the Mets. It would be nice not, even if it's just barely a winning record, I want to have a winning record against the Mets.
Yeah.
Just fuck them.
It doesn't matter how good of a winning record it is. It really doesn't. As long as it's a positive. You're absolutely right on that. Obviously, the idea is to smash them in every contest, like the 14-3 victory the Phillies had over the Mets. I know John Stolness talked about how cathartic that was on his last episode of Hidden Season. But it kind of made all the difference winning that third game. The first game, really losing that first game in extras by a run at home to the Mets, it really made it essential emotionally for the Phillies to win the other two games of that series, because good Lord, that was just not a series you wanted to lose.
No.
I don't know. I mean, we talk a lot about rivals and which teams you hate the most. And, we've pretty much played every team in the NL East to this point so far this year. And I gotta say, I'm still hating the Nationals the most. And I think it's pretty obvious why. I think that rivalry is going to take the most root this year and probably in the years to come, but certainly most passionately this year with obviously the added drama of Bryce Harper coming to the Phillies and just the whole way that series went and just the dynamic is different. Like I obviously we hate the Mets here and we want the Mets to lose and we want to beat the Mets and have a winning record against the Mets. But when Phillies and Mets fans are going at each other, And we've talked about this too. We're very similar beings. We're just wearing different colors. There's the underdog thing, whether it's the Phillies, Philadelphia with New York, or with the Mets versus not being the most popular team in New York in their own sport. There's just a lot of similarities and parallels to draw, and we all have pretty much the same temperament, and that is like passionate anger. Whereas the Nationals, it's like we're worked up and passionate and angry, and they're just like, "Don't hit me," but also just also kind of like you don't belong here. Just kinda, it's just very whiny. That's the National fan voice in my head. That sort of high pitched child, like a boy king kind of thing. Like the men are on the field; they're not playing up to my expectations.
You're imagining them as like somehow more impotent Joffrey from Game of Thrones.
Yeah. Yeah. Very like sickly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Hey, look, our favorite Washington journalist, Thomas Boswell, pointed out today, this is a national super fan who has apparently worked his way through the ranks of Washington, D.C. area sports journalism to become a very respected columnist in that area. But yeah, Thomas Boswell, who is from our,
makes me not want to move back there ever. I went to college in DC and we've been considering moving back to the area, and it makes me not, for many, many reasons, it makes me not want to go.
Boswell's a very, he's an interesting guy in that, yeah, he is very much, I think he's like one of the presidents running the president race during the Nationals games at this point. And he's just a big old super fan. But in his position as this prominent sports columnist, he writes very loving, glowing reviews of anything that Sean Doolittle or Juan Soto does, and writes very negative things about things like now Bryce Harper does. And in this case, he's just, this week he made a point to just state facts, and those facts are very positive in the Nationals' favor and very negative in Bryce Harper's favor. Like he pointed out today, since getting on base in his last 8 straight plate appearances in Nats Park, Bryce Harper has hit .178 in 12 games with 1 homer and an OPS of .616. So not like insulting Bryce the way he did when he said he was the most self-absorbed athlete he'd ever seen. Which even a few of his colleagues I saw couldn't get on board with. But at the same time, you know, yeah, you lack some context there, like things like, yes, but the Phillies are in first place. The other members of their team, as Matt Winkleman pointed out, members of the Phillies are doing very well. And I don't know, does anyone expect Bryce Harper to hit .178 for the rest of the season? I mean, even if he did and the rest of the lineup kept doing what they're doing, I have no problems with what's happening.
I think he would have a problem with it, but he would also be, you know, it's a team effort. Like, you know, the point of getting so many good players was that this would happen. They could carry the team when not everything is working well. Because you need to have every team needs to do one thing really well, at least.
Yeah.
The Phillies haven't had that for a while. This year they have it. So it doesn't matter. He'll get there. Shut up, that guy. Jesus.
On top of that,
it seems like a delightful person to hang out with. Really, right?
This is the guy.
I'm sure he really loves attending a baseball game with that giant stick in the mud.
I wish I could remember. I don't even think he's a stick in the mud. I think he's just kind of like a giggling little kid with a beanie on. Like, that's just kind of, he enjoys baseball and he enjoys taunting those who are a part of baseball that he doesn't agree with. And he loves the Nationals. He just loves the Nationals.
I'm imagining a member of the Lollipop.
This is a guy he's the same guy who tweeted that thing and then eventually deleted it because he got absolutely ratioed to death. I wish I could remember the exact quote, but like I said, it is gone now. He said something to the tune of like, Gabe Kapler is managing with a computer. Juan Soto is playing as a ball player. That is not it, but it was just that kind of thing where he's like, Gabe Kapler is managing with stats. Juan Soto is just a ball player, and he's just so pure and good, and America and the flag and soldiers and freedom and baseball and the pastime and grass and the seams of the ball.
He's playing with
and fathers and sons and all that. Yeah, it's just, it's all inside Juan Soto, and it all comes out whenever he swings the bat. It's beautiful.
This is the Nationals super fan. Says so much about the Nationals, about the Washington, D.C. area. No disrespect, but I mean, every area has a psychosis. Philadelphia's
deep. Do you think?
We are a fucked up people, but man, just like the weird surface, everything is just weird and surface and shallow, but it's just so concentrated in this one area. Like, it's so bizarre. That is their super fan.
I gotta ask, who is the? We don't even have to name names because, frankly, I hate naming names among Philadelphia media. But there isn't really anybody who is like a Phillies or Philadelphia sports like super fan supporter columnist in our area, right? They're all at the end of the day, they all default to, this is why the team sucks. This team needs to do better.
Yeah, I was just going to say, we all default to that's part of who we are. Everyone defaults to negativity. Everyone defaults to there is something wrong. This is bad. You know, even when the team is doing well, they're doing badly because instead of, you know, practicing and swinging the bat, you know, Ryan Howard is, you know, at a water park.
There's a couple of columnists whose job is very transparently to when something has happened or something is going on, whether it's a particular moment or a team doing pretty well, like catching a hot streak, or a team on the you know, doing really poorly and losing a lot. There's very transparently a bunch of writers whose job is to pick either a positive or negative direction and just go really hard in that direction for their column for the sole purpose of getting people to read and respond to it. Like, you're either going to get this glowing praise that talks about, oh, that extra pitch he took in batting practice helped him get that, helped him muscle that ball over the fence in the seventh. And this is poetry and baseball and America, and, like, you know, get into that. But there's also, like, the negative direction of, like, oh, you guys are all enjoying the Sixers? Well, guess what? Joel Embiid ran over a cow with his car last summer. How do you feel about that, idiots? And you're like, okay, great. So we're all idiots. Fine. But, yeah, I think part of the job is to make fans feel stupid about being fans here. You do get that vibe from certain writers, certain columns. That's way more likely in Philadelphia than I think, like a story about how wonderful it is that the Phillies are good again. You'll get a couple of those as the summer rolls on and there's some, like, undeniably good moments, but yeah, I don't think there's anybody whose job is like cheerleader the way there is in DC clearly. So yeah, that's interesting. I don't think there's as many differences culturally between the cities and sports fan bases as we tend to portray it, but that definitely is one. And that's really interesting to me. One of the other things that contributed to now that we've played all these NL East teams, and I'm saying that the Nationals are still my least favorite. One of the things is, so the Nationals Twitter account, it has, like all Major League Baseball Twitter accounts, adopted a much more, well, like all corporate accounts at this point, where they've all adopted much more, you know, conversational, personable tones, where they're going to, like, use memes and GIFs instead of just, like, you know, what, like 5-10 years ago, you were just seeing, like, come see the Nationals tonight, here's a link for tickets, and, like, that's what social media was used for. Now they're using them, they're, like, letting people run them and like young people run them, and who, like, know how to communicate with people in the but the Nationals Twitter account, now twice now, we all remember back when Bryce Harper came to Nationals Park for the first time and he struck out in his first at bat, and the Nationals Twitter account tweeted thank you next. It's like a burn, like, oh yeah, like, that's, you know, we broke up and now you struck out here, and, like, we clearly won this deal. And then Bryce Harper went on to go 3-for-5 with a home run, and the Phillies crushed the Nationals in that game. I think they won like 8-2. But again, today, the Nationals played the Giants. I mean, the Giants are one of the worst teams in the National League, right? I know early season standings might indicate otherwise. I'm not pulling the NL West standings off the top of my head, but certainly they aren't projected to be one of the most menacing lineups in baseball this season. That I'm sure is true.
No, they're 8-12.
Right. Okay. So it's, you know,
they're better than the Rockies right now.
Wow. I didn't realize the Rockies were in last place.
The Rockies are 6-12. I am surprised at that as well. I mean, it's still early season, but, you know, we're starting to approach the point where teams kind of have to get hot unless they want this to follow them around all season.
Seriously, the Rockies haven't won at home yet. They're 0-5 at Coors Field. I had no idea things were going that weirdly in Colorado. Quick side note, since I'm looking at the standings, the Reds haven't won on the road. They are 0-7 outside of Great American Ballpark. That's
they've had some problems. Yeah. They've had some
issues. Well, in any case, Marlins are 1-9 in their last 10. In any case, the Nationals, the Nationals played the Giants today. We're recording on Thursday night, and Patrick Corbin pitched, and I'm sure we all remember, I actually forgot, but I'm sure we all remember that the Phillies were suddenly in on signing Patrick Corbin at one point this offseason when someone...
Yeah, that seems like a billion years ago.
1 billion years ago when someone on 95 spotted Patrick Corbin wearing a Phillies hat on the Jumbotron inside Citizens Bank Park, and suddenly everybody scrambled to be like, wait a second, Patrick Corbin doesn't play for the Phillies, and there's not a baseball game going on right now. What's going on? And we figured it out. We got to the bottom of that one. And it turned out, at the end of the day, Patrick Corbin, who was said to be going to the Yankees, most likely went to the Nationals. And he got, what, a 6-year deal with the Nats? And, you know, that was the reason the Phillies didn't sign him and the Nationals did was because the Phillies had a certain amount of years they were willing to give a starting pitcher. 6 years was outside of that. I remember John Stolness at the time saying, if you're willing to go five, are you seriously not willing to go six? But they stayed hard and fast on that rule, did not sign Patrick Corbin, didn't sign anybody new for their rotation, which may come back to bite them, but adjustments will probably be made along the way. But the point is, he wound up with the Nationals, and there were certainly people who thought a 6-year deal was too much to give a starting pitcher. And that obviously was, you know, that critique was obviously absorbed by the Nationals, or at least the person running the Nationals Twitter account, who tweeted in that alternating caps and lowercase mocking fashion today after Corbin pitched 7 2/3 and only gave up 2 hits, 1 earned run, 1 walk, and 9 strikeouts, and said, can't give Patrick Corbin 6 years, though, which is how I pronounce that when they do the lowercase and uppercase thing, which, again, seemed like the thank you next tweet seemed awfully premature. It seemed like they had a pretty good idea for something and they just couldn't wait to pull the trigger on it. Because when you think about it for more than 1 second, fourth start for the Nationals as part of a 6-year deal is probably not the time. Like, by the same logic, the Bryce Harper signing for 13 years will have absolutely no bad times. And especially as someone pointed out on Twitter, that this is the same team that refused to give Bryce Harper the deal he wanted. They're now mocking people for saying 6 years was too long for Patrick Corbin. It's just all kinds of weird logic. Like I said to some of the Good Fight staffers today, that it seems like the person running that Twitter account, they do know what they're doing and they are like kind of clever, but they're just not quite there. Like, they're just, they aren't nailing it yet. They're very anxious, I think, to be to offer these scathing burns. And that sort of lends itself to the overall idea of these Nationals being unable to shake this little brother syndrome that has been going on for years, since before they were the most dominant team in the NL East to now. It maintained that status while they were the best team in the NL East. They just couldn't break through and, I don't know, like, be taken seriously. I think that's probably true, because the whole never got past the first round of the playoffs thing is still on them. So I think they're just very anxious to prove their haters wrong. It's just that it's going to take a lot more time than 3 or 4 Patrick Corbin starts or 1 Bryce Harper at bat to be as right as they want to be. I don't know. What do you think?
The insecurity of Nationals fans is always going to delight me, because, like, this is all, it's all so needy and desperate. You know, I'll grant that it has a personality, and you want your social media presence to have a strong personality.
I mean, they're doing a good job. If I was a Nationals fan, I would be like, yeah, great. Yeah, this isn't, I'm not blasting the person. It's more just that, like, no, you said, the insecurity that comes out.
That's who they're trying to get on their side, you know, and they're trying to make everyone else angry, and it's working. But, like, I look back at all the chances they had, and I look back at something like the 2015 World Series, where the Mets, an NL East team that was surprisingly good, in a year where the Nationals were surprisingly bad. The Nationals, in their tip-top shape, I think could have beaten the Royals. This could have been their year to do it, and they sucked too much.
I absolutely agree with that. The Nationals were a good enough team to win the World Series, certainly in 2015 and other years during that time as well. Absolutely. Absolutely. I was worried that playoff series between the Cardinals and the Nationals, where it looked like the Nationals were going to win and then the Cardinals stole it with a late comeback. I mean, first of all, that was a playoff series from hell. That's like watching a Braves Yankees World Series like we had to in the 90s. But, like, it was also just like, all right, well, at least something gut wrenching happened to one of these teams. Obviously, it sucks that one of them had to win for that to happen. But, like, you know, it's great that at least one of them got hurt. And it was just always the Nationals who got hurt. So, yeah, first time through the NL East, my feelings feel like they have not changed too much. And I think it's more fun when the Mets are the team that you hate the most, because it's more just like screaming in a mirror or yeah, it's more like you're,
well, because they're equal to the task,
right? You're fighting a fight. You both know how to fight. Like the Nationals never, Nationals fans never seem like they know what they're doing when you're.
We all know how to wound each other. We all know how to not wound each other. Yes. Like we're not just flailing around with like, you know, with like weird, you know, 10 knife contraptions on our hands, just stabbing at the air, which it feels like that's what that's like the Nationals aura, you know, when they fight just like an inflatable noodle man, but with knives. Like Mets fans and Phillies fans are concentrated. They know what they're doing.
Oh, man. And we're going to talk more about these knife contraptions Liz wears on her fingers right after we come back from this break. And we're back talking some present Phillies before we get to the past Phillies, as we do on Continued Success. We talk about last year, we talked about the 2008 and 1993 seasons, which, hey, if you're ever going on a long car ride or getting on a plane and you're a Phillies fan and wants to reminisce about the good old days, our chronicle of the 93 and 2008 seasons are as relevant as they were last year when we recorded them. This year, we are doing the same thing for the 2009 Phillies, who are, again, I would say celebrating their 10-year anniversary. But as we get into these teams that did not win the World Series, I don't know if they celebrate the anniversary as much. We're still, like in 2021, we're going to be like, we're celebrating the anniversary of Ryan Howard's heartbreaking Achilles tear. And the heart of a city melting over the course of one at bat.
Like in 2010, it'll essentially be, let's celebrate Roy Halladay for the year. Do that and not think about how, oh man, that's going to be a postseason we talk about with so many swear words.
I got to tell you, I'm genuinely not looking forward to it. I don't want to talk about the 2010 playoffs. That was such a miserable, just gut wrenching time to be watching. It's going to be the most probably entertaining
series. Fine.
Yes.
That first series was great. I think we can talk about that with no problem, but like we'll have to do it. It's our job. This is what we've signed up for.
We have to do it, Justin. I love we're recording the podcast. You're convincing me to continue doing the podcast while we're recording the podcast. People are going to hear this.
Justin, I'm convincing you to go on.
Well, before we get to what was going on with the 2009 team around this time, I did just want to touch on one more thing, and that was Liz. Really a big topic this week, as it becomes a couple of times a season, is bat flipping, comma, repercussions of vengeance. So as if you're a baseball fan, which God help you if you're not a baseball fan and you're listening to my voice right now.
But
if you're
like, stop, I have a lot of other suggestions for you.
We'll get to our potted plant podcast right after this. It's called the Potted Cast. So what happened this week in baseball was that Tim Anderson of the White Sox hit a home run and flipped his bat against the Royals. The Royals obviously didn't like that. I forget the pitcher's name. Was it Brad Anderson? It was like somebody in your office's name. threw at Tim.
Your friendly neighborhood insurance agent.
Right. He threw at Tim Anderson. I think if the pitcher and the batter both had the same last name, that probably would have come up. So it was probably not Brad Anderson. These are the things we should probably look up before the podcast begins. Anyway, so Tim Anderson hits this home run against the Royals, and he really sells it, which obviously you and I have made very clear we are in deep support of. But the Royals pitcher didn't like it, threw at him, hit him in the butt, and then the benches cleared in Kansas City, despite the fact that, I mean, you know, I'm pretty much speaking about it in the broadest possible terms. But if you zoom in at all, this was another really stupidly managed one of these incidents. So Tim Anderson's like walking to first base after he's been hit. He had to know it was coming. Everyone in the stadium and watching at home knew it was coming. And as he's walking to first base, the catcher is talking to him. And he's sort of patting the catcher on his chest protector. And you kind of got, you know, if you're not hearing what they're saying and you're just watching on TV, you kind of get the sense like he knows what's going on. He's a little worked up, but he's also just saying like, I get it, whatever. Eventually, this turns into a bench clearing situation. Joe West, who is, of course, the umpire overseeing this, because who else would be overseeing this? He ejects Tim Anderson for, I think they said, because he went towards the mound, which eventually I think he did. The Royals pitcher was also ejected. The managers went at it, which is awesome. They looked like Rick Renneria and Ned Yost of the Royals. They went at it at one point.
Dad and Grandpa fighting.
Oh, yeah, real aggressive. I think they both got ejected as well. At least one of them did. But Liz, I wanted to talk about this because, so we've talked bat flipping and, you know, we're obviously big support of it. We're a big supporter of player jubilation and excitement in general. We are not a fan of, and tell me when I should stop speaking for you. We are not a fan of the pitcher throwing the baseball at the hitter in retaliation or another hitter in retaliation. When logic dictates getting him out the next time is a way more effective method of showing him who's boss. But in any case, Liz, I want to go back to the bat flip because I keep calling it a bat flip. And what I kept not saying as everyone discussed this week was that Tim Anderson didn't flip his bat. He threw his bat at the Royals dugout and then also yelled at them to further antagonize him. So when I say that everyone in the stadium knew what was coming, including Tim Anderson, that's sort of what I'm talking about, because it wasn't just like he watched it or he was like a young guy watching his first home run sail out of Yankee Stadium or something. He was antagonizing the Royals on purpose, which again, yeah, I'm not saying that's not cool. I'm just saying, don't you think he does something like that knowing full well what will happen?
Yeah, of course he does. Everyone knows. Like, I think baseball writers and some fans are the only ones that might care about this. Like, I care about it, I do, but baseball players for the most part don't seem to care. They mostly want to be left alone. Let me do my bat flip. Let me respond like an angry idiot. You know, like, I think you don't want to be throwing things at people, but baseball players are going to do what they're going to do. You know, like, the bat throw and yell was just NBA style.
Mm-hmm.
Like, Ben Simmons at the end of the half, is that like during in the game against the Nets tonight, dunked and screamed, you know, a very, I am man, hear me roar type of, it was amazing. I loved it. Like, and that's, they don't go after each other. Like, I think maybe everyone needs to chill. I would like everyone to chill, but also the baseball players are going to do what they do. There are already rules in place to discourage them. I don't think they're going to get any stricter.
Yeah, exactly. Like, what else is there to be done here? I say it was poorly managed by the umpires, but I don't know what an.
That was Joe West's first four ejection game in his. He's gunning for the record in games umpired total. Man. He isn't retiring till he hits it. He's got like another season and a half.
So, okay. So he had his own motivations for being a part of that then. It is just amazing. He was, of course, the crew chief there in that particular moment. And there was some more, you know, this became a bit more of a talking point because some players commented on it. Marcus Stroman. Marcus Stroman commented on it saying like, all right, and Amir Garrett of the Reds, another pitcher, also pretty much said the same thing. They were like, look, you can do whatever you want when you get hit a home run off me. Just understand that I'm going to like moonwalk off the field when I get you out next time. And that's like, yeah, that's what we're talking about. Like, that's exactly right. Yes,
that's
do that. And then, yeah, Randall Grichuk was like, you know, the guys are getting a little excessive on pimping home runs, on meaningless home runs. Act like you've done it before one time. I don't understand. Like, I do get why the phrase act like you've done it before exists. It's like, don't be a child when everyone else is trying to be a professional. But this is a sport. This is what, you know, office culture is in professional sports. Everybody's really worked up and wound up tight. Why he felt like he had to. Well, first of all, well, actually, the best part of this is that he says all this. Maybe what, like an hour later, a couple hours after the Tim Anderson thing becomes the talking point of the baseball day. And then Tim Anderson responds to him and says, put a name on this so we can see who you're talking about, bro. And Randall Grichuk, after like responding to Tim Anderson and talking to the press later was like, whoa, whoa, I didn't really think, I wasn't talking about anyone in particular. How could you think that? That's crazy.
And you, like, must feel guilty about something you've done. If you think that I'm talking about you, who wants to guess where I used to play? Yes, the St. Louis Cardinals.
Right. As if he, like, rolled out of the cat bed he sleeps in and was just like, I'm having some strong feelings about bat flipping on home runs for no particular reason. I'm totally unaware of what's in the news today. I'm just feeling very passionately about that. And apropos of nothing, I will be tweeting about it right now. That was absolutely hysterical. But the truth is, Liz, I'm just, like a lot of things we've talked about on this podcast and on other podcasts, I feel like I've just said everything I need to say about this particular topic. And I think I'm ready just for a cultural shift as far as this goes, because it's a conversation that doesn't need to be had anymore. We all make the same points every time. And like you said, there's not a really good way to really manage the situation anyway. So I think you're never going to eliminate bench clearing situations from baseball. But I do think, and this is how I think it's going to change, that you're going to see more and more guys like Amir Garrett, like Marcus Stroman, like that take on things sort of overtake the old school, I'm going to hit this guy with the baseball in revenge mentality. I think that's what's going to happen. And I think that's great, because we do need to see more pitchers moonwalking in baseball. I've been saying that for years. No, that's actually one point I haven't made on any of these baseball podcasts, but I'm making it today, and I'm going to stand by it for decades to come. Now, before we go ahead.
The only point I want to make is if the best fans in baseball turned into a person, it would be Randall Grichuk.
Referring, of course, to Cardinals fans who, is that even, yeah. Do they even still, like, that idea has been mocked to death, I feel like. They can't possibly still think that. I mean, I'm sure there's a couple of grandmas and grandpas.
Go check out Cardinals Twitter sometime.
Yeah, I'd rather not. All right.
Yeah, no, don't do it. I don't do it. Just trust me. I know a good Cardinals fan.
Wow.
I do. Tara Wellman, she does a lot of YouTube stuff about the Cardinals. She's great, and you should follow her because she is the opposite of obnoxious. I like her a lot. She is the only good Cardinals fan.
Wow. Well, you found her. That's terrific. Way to go, Liz. Now we know there's one out there. Before we completely run out of time, we should get to the 2009 season that we chronicle so entertainingly on this podcast. And Liz, you know, last week we talked about the passing of Harry Callis, the 10-year anniversary of which passed on April 13th without a whole lot of pageantry, unless I missed something. I didn't see a whole lot of items just about that it's been 10 years since Harry Callis died. I don't know. Did you see anything that caught your eye?
No, I didn't. And I think that's okay.
Yeah. It's just a little surprising that I just inadvertently didn't have something dropped in front of my face about it. It just seems like that's something we would talk about. But we did talk about it. And the ripple effects of Harry Callis's passing are going to be felt through all of through this episode as well, just because obviously he was a fixture for the Phillies, and subtracting him from the equation left a void. And you can see that just as a lot of the games that came in the wake of his passing really just passed through this filter of the tragedy of Harry Callis's death.
Things just changed immediately.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It was
like, it's to think like that. You know, there are very few things that can happen, like, that you listen to every day. You know, it's a huge change. Like, you think about it all the time then.
Yeah, and that, it was clear that certainly immediately after, it was obviously on everyone's minds, but it continued to be. And we're going to talk about a couple of series the Phillies played in mid to late April, and you can just see that Harry was just on everybody's minds. The Phillies and Nationals actually debated on whether they would play their scheduled game the day of Harry Callis's passing, and determined that they should do so because that's what Harry would have wanted, which is a beautiful sentiment and also true. But in reading that and remembering that, I'm also feeling like it's very likely that this is also what the league would have wanted by a happy coincidence, that somebody was maybe like, so you can't not play this game. Like, it's very sad, but you got to play this game. I don't know if it would probably be unprecedented, I would say, if like baseball has a lot of legendary figures who aren't actual baseball players. And I don't know, it just seems like it would take, it just seems like there's the league would have balked at the idea of them not playing that game.
Yeah. I mean, like the manager would have had to have died.
Right.
Like a player would have had to, like even the owner dying wouldn't cause the Phillies to not play a game, but like someone on the field would have to die. Like that's the only way that a game would not be played.
Right.
So, you know, I can't imagine them not playing. like it was sad, but it's what he would have wanted.
And it is true, yes, that is what he would have wanted, I think. So they played on, and according to Jim Salisbury of the Inquirer, it was Shane Victorino who sent somebody out for a pack of smokes, what Harry called heaters, and a bunch of the Phillies lit up and took an honorary drag before the game in honor of their broadcaster who had called each of their names so passionately. Apparently they all took one drag and then immediately put it out, which is like how this was conveyed in the media. But like, you know, I'm sure a couple of them smoked the cigarette, you know.
I'm sure. I mean, but it's also you're smoking. I mean, unless any of them smoke regularly, they're going to smoke a cigarette before a baseball game.
Oh, yeah. Just like hacking up a lung as they round second base. You can just see Shane Victorino.
I smoked in college. I'm never going back.
No, exactly. But it is. Yeah, it's just funny that they made sure to tell you like, hey, look, the Phillies, they all took a drag, one single drag as a salute to Harry Callis and how he shaped his voice with parliaments over the years. And then that was it. There was nothing. Then they smothered them and no one ever talked or thought about smoking ever again. So after that, it was time to play some ball. Now, Liz, when we last left the Phillies in 2009, they were 3-3, having disappointing home series to start the season against the Braves before taking 2 out of 3 from the Rockies in the swirling winds of Denver. They were stopped now in Washington for 2 games before a 6-game homestand against the Padres and the Brewers. Liz, just because this is what they had to do, and this is what people even closer to Harry Callis had to do, guys who had worked with him, guys like Larry Anderson and Scott Fransky, who were obviously very emotional in the wake of Harry Callis passing. Have you ever had to do your job or anything like really important while grieving like this? Because it has got to be just like working and living in a bubble. Especially as an athlete where your job is like difficult and based to a certain extent on chance to begin with. And now you got to do this with this pall just sort of cast over everything and be tough to like enjoy your work or even do it well. So I don't know. Have you ever had to do your job while grieving?
I haven't. No.
Yeah.
Not really. I mean, I don't know if I would count like my grandfather passed away last year and I had to work for the few days before, you know, we went to the funeral. That was
tough
sad.
To concentrate. Yeah, sure. My grandfather passed away in high school and I had to, my grandfather passed away when I was in high school. That would have been crazy. And he, I had to go work on a science project at somebody's house the day he passed away. And I remember that was particularly challenging, to concentrate on what I was doing. So I'm just trying to paint a picture of how difficult it must have been for everyone in the Phillies organization at this point, because clearly he was on everyone's minds. They hung his jacket in the dugout. They put his shoes in the dugout. They, you know, they did pretty much everything they could to commemorate him on a moment's notice. But now the Phillies and the Nats had to play a ball game. So they slapped a few runs past each other early and Jamie Moyer leaked a few runs for the Nationals and Daniel Cabrera pitching for the Nationals walked in a guy and got victimized by an error. The Phillies were up 4-3 when Elijah Dukes, who already had an RBI. One of the things about this podcast is looking when you're reading about the opposition is remembering like, oh my God, that guy. And Elijah Dukes, oh my God, that guy'd the Phillies pretty hard in this series. So the Phillies were up 4-3 when Dukes, who already had an RBI double on the day, hit a game tying home run in the fifth. And it was a tie game until the top of the seventh. So Ryan Howard, who had his picture in the paper that day, dumping a beer on Harry Callis's head, I think following the World Series, stepped in and crushed a 3-run bomb to break the tie, saying afterwards, "I'm sure Harry was calling it from the booth in the sky."
Oh, God.
Yeah.
I'm just... That's surprisingly
Ryan's
eloquent.
Got this. Yeah, I mean, he's always had this gentle eloquence about him. I think he's got a poet's spirit in there, in that chant for him.
He does, yeah. Kind of.
Raul Ibanez added another home run that inning, and Brad Lidge tried to blow the save because this is 2009, remember? And Cole Hamels and Brad Lidge are bad now. But
no, like, this is like, talking about Brad Lidge, I'm going to go back and see if I can find some videos, because this is, I remember in 2011, 2012, listening to fantasy podcasts, and even then, like 2013, they were still talking about Brad Lidge having the worst season for a closer in
Incredible.
The history of the game. Like, they would say, you can't, you know, I don't think he's going to turn into a Brad Lidge. And I'm just like, I nearly stopped the car in the middle of the street. I'm like, it is 2013.
Someone has to have had a worse season. And then you look at the numbers and you're like, no.
No.
It's incredible. I mean, that's got to be the biggest, most clear example of like how regression always finds you, that like the pendulum swings one way and then it swings back the other way. And Brad Lidge, it certainly swung. Yeah.
Swung back so hard. Yeah, he broke the side of the
he
clock.
He certainly ran out of time. and with that scorching heater in the books, we'll be right back after this break. Well, yeah, Brad Lidge didn't quite blow the save in that game, and the Phillies managed to win their first game without Harry against the Nationals 9-8. Likely exhausted, though, the Phillies did not come out firing the next day. Joe Blanton allowed a 3-run home run early, and the Phillies never crawled out of that hole with a reliever named Jack Tashner. Do you remember this person, Liz?
No, he sounds like he... It sounds like he belongs on an episode of the Zany 70s
sitcom. Or even like
sitcom.
He's a main character. Yeah, it's Jack Tashner. Yeah. Pitch for the Phillies. Relief pitcher. He allowed the Nationals to run roughshod over him in the eighth with two walks, two home runs, and a pair of RBI singles. Your best friend Elijah Dukes had one of the home runs. He was on fire. And
he's my best
friend. Your man
now,
Elijah. He was on fire in this series for some reason. For the 2009 Phillies, now it was back to Philadelphia, where Harry was again honored at home. This obviously being their first trip back to Philadelphia since Harry Callis passed away. And in his honor, which we say in retrospect, in truth, it just happened because it was a baseball game. But in his honor, Chase Utley hit a 3-run shot, which, as one of Harry's favorite players to watch, seemed also poetic in the way that Chase Utley tells poems, which is silently with his teeth like grinding together and a home run going over the fence.
The quickest home run
I didn't
run
look
in
it
baseball.
Up. I'm sure there's this information is somewhere, but they mentioned Chase was one of Harry's favorite players to watch. I would love to know who the others were, because in the, you know, decades in which Harry Callis watched and covered the Phillies, to be one of his favorite Phillies and players to watch has got to be really distinctive. I mean, just anybody who's watched the team for that long and how many players you've seen come and go, and even just good players stay with the team for a while. You know, that's to be the favorite is something. And then to be Harry Callis, one of Harry Callis's favorites, who obviously knows what he's doing when he's watching baseball and talking about baseball and understanding why baseball players are good. Like that's quite an accomplishment, I would say. But you know, Chase Elliott was a lot of people's favorite baseball players for exactly that reason. So anyway, less poetic, Liz, was Cole Hamels' start and also Ryan Madsen giving up 3 runs in the eighth inning. Yeah, you forgot, didn't you? We're sitting here harping on Brad Lidge and Cole Hamels in 2009, but bad Ryan Madsen was also hanging around. So he gave up 3 runs in the eighth inning. The Phillies were up 5-0 in the first and 7-3 in the sixth until Hamels gave up a 2-run shot to make it 7-5, and Madsen couldn't keep the Padres from scoring late. They lost 8-7, a gut-punching L that honestly was the type of game Harry had seen so much more of through his tenure, and in that vein was probably even more appropriate for them to do in their first game back in Philadelphia since he died. I remember being in Oscar's Tavern, and seeing Heath Bell strike out Matt Stairs to end that game. And Heath Bell was really, really psyched about striking him out and winning that game. And I remember it really pissed me off. Like, not like he should have let the Phillies win, obviously, but he knew what was going on there. And, you know, he knew what the situation was. And I get that it's like a big win to beat a team that, like, the narrative is really suggesting that not only just because of what's going on, you know, win it for Harry, obviously that is flowing, but also that they were up by 5 runs in the first. It just had a sort of narrative going for it that seemed like the Phillies were going to win, and then his team came back and won, and he got to strike the last guy out and win it for the Padres. But at the same time, it was like, shut up. We're in mourning, you dick. Stop pumping your fist. Ah, fortunately, I was at Oscars, so I could order beers twice the size of normal beers, and that calmed me down. That was one of the rare times, I guess, I was in Oscars and I hadn't forgotten they were cash only. So, yeah.
That's what I'm... By the way, I had to look up whether this was the season Ryan Madsen kicked a chair after blowing a save.
Broke his toe.
And broke his toe and spent 8 weeks on the then disabled list. No, that's next season. So I'll mark my calendar for that.
Way
one.
To go with the then disabled list. I got to say, collectively, we're all doing a really good job calling it the injured list. Yeah. I haven't seen anyone say the disabled list yet. I'm sure someone has, but just as a baseball community, for some reason, we all just really made a point to get that right. And I'd say we are nailing it, frankly.
Well, and, you know, I don't think there was a ton of complaining.
For like, once, yeah.
For once. Like some people complained, but, like, it's changed.
Who's gonna romanticize the disabled list? Like, I remember.
Yeah, I mean, it makes sense to change it. They are mm-hmm. injured.
I remember seeing somebody yeah. talk about, like, oh, don't you remember the, like, experience and the pleasure you got from going into a video store and just browsing the titles and just learning about movies. No. And someone was like, we will just romanticize everything that doesn't exist anymore to make us think we enjoyed it. Nobody was wild about that. Why do you think Netflix became so popular? Because nobody had to drive to a store and pick out a movie anymore. You could just be like, blurp, done. And I'd say if anybody complained about the disabled list changing its name, it's probably that kind of person. Like, I remember opening the paper as a boy and turning to the middle page, not the back page or the front page, one of the middle pages of the illustrious sports section of the newspaper back then, and just finding the teeny tiny little names that are part of the MLB disabled list and learning who had destroyed their bodies the night before hard enough that they were no longer allowed to play the game. And we called it the disabled list because of some reason, but that was the tradition.
Cram it, Gramps. My God. Like, at the grocery store this week, we're just walking down an aisle and an old man comes up to me and says, I'm looking at bread, trying to pick out a loaf of bread. And he says, you know, when I was your age, bread was 25 cents a loaf, and it took everything I had to be like, that sound like, tell me more tales about how things were better when you were 30.
Sir,
Gramps.
Do you need some money? Is that what this is about?
Like, I don't, like, what is the point? Like, of course I know that things used to be cheaper. I was so, why do I need to, can I just buy bread in peace?
He probably just wants somebody to talk to. He was probably like, you look a lot like my granddaughter. And you were like, get the fuck out of my face.
Listen, this would happen on the East Coast, maybe, but I'd be there within my rights to say, hey, oh, leave me alone. In the Midwest, I can't do that in the Midwest.
That was probably
they are all passive aggressive. The tone out here is passive aggressive, while my tone as an East Coaster is get the fuck away.
It was probably the
owner
of the grocery store or the mayor of a nearby town.
I wouldn't be surprised. God forsaken.
Well, in any case, this game that the Phillies lost to the Padres in 2009, their first home game since Harry's passing, it was also the first game that they used Harry's out of here call over the speakers after the Phillies hit a home run on Chase's first inning drive. And they've continued doing that today. And it is a move that is one of their best stadium elements. They've changed a lot in Citizens Bank Park since it opened in 2004. But I just think it's not it's not like too creative of a move, but it's a necessary one and a good one. It sort of builds, it allows the Phillies culture to just build on itself. You know, like that wouldn't mean anything to anyone without Phillies baseball. And now it's going to be a part of Phillies baseball forever. And that is how you build a subculture. And that's terrific. And that you get to still, that Harry's still a part of it. And that he still gets to make that call every time is brilliant. And that Chase Utley was the first one to hit the home run and hear it was also deeply appropriate.
Yeah. I'm not sure when they started playing High Hopes at the end of the games, but, you know, my dad and I only started going to games together, you know, 2009, actually. We'll talk about my first ever Phillies game happened in 2009.
Damn. Yeah, we got it.
I know, we'll be able to talk about it. I have a lot of memories. But like all of our together memories include, you know, hearing High Hopes at the end, you know, when the Phillies win. And I love that. Like for me, like we'll stand there and we'll both sort, you know, we'll both cheer up. It's a moment for us that we always like, because, you know, Harry is a connecting, you know, something that.
Yeah, you do
us.
Still get, I get a little bit choked up every time you hear it. Really. Usually when they win, if they lose, I'm just trying to get out of the stadium, but when they.
Oh yeah. But like, you can always tell who, because everyone who stays until it plays is staying to hear it specifically. And I love seeing the people who, you know, it's always a fair amount of people who stay and sing, and it always makes me happy to see, because he's still, you're right, he's still a part of what we do. Like, I can't imagine they'll stop playing that until they move to a new stadium, which is going to be a while, because it's not happening anytime
and also
in the next decade.
Why stop doing it then either? Like he's going to be, I guess at some point there will be people who have never heard of Harry Callis going to Phillies games, but that feels like a deeply ahead of, like, very far into the future.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm thinking, I mean, they're going to spend a lot of, I mean, I don't think they'll leave Citizens Bank Park for quite a while. I can't imagine where they go or what they do. They're going to, Citizens Bank Park is going to be around for a long time. And so when I say it's when they move to another stadium, it's whenever they, you know, it'll be at least 15 years.
Oh, yeah.
If not longer.
I would hope longer.
Which means it'll be almost 30 in the stadium.
Well, the next night.
Like at that point, it might make sense to stop playing it, but also I don't want them to ever stop.
You heard it here first, folks. Liz demands they stop playing it. I've got high hopes that I never hear this song again. Well, the next night, the Phillies lost again, thanks in part to Ryan Madsen and thanks in part to Brad Lidge giving up runs. The Padres scored 6 times in the game's final 2 innings. Madsen allowed a walk and 2 singles that put the Padres up 4-3, but Chase Utley and the Phillies offense came back in the bottom of the inning to make it 5-4. Lidge couldn't hold the lead, gave up 4 runs, and from that deficit, the Phillies could not come back and lost 8-5. It was Lidge's first blown save since September 23rd, 2007, a streak that included 54 saves. Yeah, he kind of... They talked to him afterwards, and he was like, you know, I knew it was going to happen eventually. And at this point, it's just a relief to, you know, have it out of the way so that the streak is over and nobody's going to be asking me about that anymore. So you get it. I mean, it was Brad Lidge. He was even keeled. He always is. Well, at the same time, a profile by Andy Martino appeared in the Inquirer on Jason Wirth, focusing on his intensity and how it had started when he was a kid. This doesn't really have anything to do with anything. I just noticed it and wanted to bring it up because it includes... It includes the passage, "At an early age, I was expected to play hard and take whatever I was doing seriously," Wirth said. Kim, his mother, recalled with a laugh the night her son responded to threats of punishment by leading his junior high school basketball team to victory. "He did awesome that night," she said. Did Jason Wirth's mother threaten to punish him if he didn't win a junior high school basketball championship?
That is terrifying. And like that whole, like... Who is this editor? Because that is so unclear. Like that whole passage is really ambiguous.
It's just bizarre. That can't be what that means, right?
It can't be. But like that is what you would. That's what you would intimate from what was said. Like that can't be right. But also, if it, like, you would hope that the editor was good enough. Like, is that what he meant, that he's just not putting a fine point on it because it's hideous.
Why that would be said, and like that they would, that Worth and his mom would both be like, oh yeah, like,
I mean, that sounds terrifying.
I mean, I don't want to question people's parenting, but isn't that sound less like a parent and more like what the antagonist's parents do in every kid's sports movie? That they're like, win, beat this kid doing the illegal move, or don't
little
come
giants,
home,
little giants.
Where they're like, hurting people is the right way to play, which, you know, back to our...
Ed O'Neill and Rick Moranis. I'm going to find that movie. I love it for some reason.
Back to our other point of, you know, pitchers throwing at hitters on purpose. In all these kids' movies, the bad guys are hurting other teams on purpose, by the way. Just a little note throw in there. Finally, in Game 3 of the Padres series, the Phillies did some comebacking of their own, courtesy of Raul Ibanez and his first ever Phillies home run. They did the Raul chant in Seattle as well. But for some reason, it was instinctive for us to do it here again. At some point in baseball fandom, anytime some player who endears himself at all is going to hear and has the ooh sound in their name, they're going to just hear an ooh chant like Chooch, like Tadahito Iguchi got that,
like,
as well.
Mike Moustakas, Moose.
Moose, everybody. Yeah, you just, that's cool. But I remember doing that, and it wouldn't be the last time they screamed Raul Ibanez's name at Citizens Bank Park. Bryce Harper got here this season and nuzzled his way into fans' hearts, not just with massive taters, but by saying and doing all the things Philadelphia loves. Raul Ibanez, as you'll recall, Liz, endeared himself to fans the old-fashioned way, by hitting .359 in March and April with an .1151 OPS. He hit 7 home runs in April, 10 more in May. Victorino got him with the shaving cream pie during his post-game interview for this game. At 37 years old, he did this. And this season, 2009, would be the only all-star season of his career. So
I love it.
I remember them announcing that they were bringing him in to replace Pat Burrell. And, you know, you thought of Pat Burrell wasn't a spring chicken anymore by the time he left Philadelphia, but you still thought of him as, you know, keeping up with the rest of the core. You know, he wasn't like the old man on the staff or anything. He was 32 years old in 2009. But here they were bringing in Raul Ibanez, who was 37. And you were just like, huh, what's going on here? And then he gets off to this incredibly hot start. I think he spun his wheels a little bit right at the beginning, but I remember that he absolutely torched National League pitching to start off the 2009 season. So that was, and that was sort of the beginning of that. And for now, the Phillies just got to bask in their series salvaging against the Padres. Now 5-6, looking to break free of the shackles of .500 baseball with the Brewers coming to town on the horizon. You know, as we'll talk about on our next episode, unfortunately, they did not again rise to the occasion in another home series. But look, you know, it started a little slow in 2009, but
like we sort of have to remind ourselves sometimes they went to the World Series this season. Their point is going to feel real, real bleak.
I mean, there's a chance that we're going to read through the events of this season and they'll just keep losing. And then we'll get to the end and be like, huh, now, according to Baseball Reference, they did not go to the World Series. And we somehow have changed history by recounting it again. So they're just watch out for that, ladies and gentlemen. But
yeah, keep your head on the swivel here.
For the most part, we're doing our best not to change history, but but that
is that is the power of Philadelphia negativity.
It actually echoes to the past and removes our glory days from the record. Yeah, it's devastating. But that's what the 2009 Phillies were up to around mid-April. We'll try to finish up April next time in our next episode and get into the real meat of the season, as the 2019 Phillies also do so. But thanks again for listening to Continued Success. And as always, subscribe, download, and rate all the podcasts that are a part of the Good Fight podcast family just by looking for The Good Fight on iTunes, on Stitcher, anywhere you get your podcasts, and telling us how pleasant of an experience you had listening to us. Also, the Patreon is always firing on all cylinders. I know John Stolness is filling our Hit and Season Patreon with bonus content. And Liz and I will do that as well as we continue our series of movie reviews and trashy novel reviews. And Trevor Strunk and I will be adding bonus content that supplements our new Dirty Inning episode, which will be on Monday. So lots of great Phillies content, as always, at The Good Fight. Thank you for listening, and we'll talk to you next time on Continued Success.